This is Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm Hope Kerwin. La Crosse is home to many organizations supporting the arts, from theater, music, visual arts, dance, and more. A new study found these nonprofit organizations contributed almost $33 million in local economic activity in 2015, supporting more than 1,000 jobs and generating more than $3 million in local and state tax revenue. Joining us to talk about the economic impact of the arts in La Crosse are Tracy Gaskin, Executive Director of the La Crosse Symphony Orchestra, Bridget Misch, Event Operations Coordinator for Viterbo University's Fine Arts Center, and Jen Robardeau, Interim Executive Director of the Weber Center for the Performing Arts. $33 million, that's a pretty large amount. And I wonder, Jen, if you feel like that number really encompasses the impact that the arts has on La Crosse.
It's surprising to see what the impact is in La Crosse. You think of the arts as being sometimes a frill on the side or something like that, but when you hear that number, $33 million, it's a significant number, and it's significant revenue generated in the city of La Crosse. So I think that just shows what a significant impact the arts have on our community, and the economic impact that they generate, not only in terms of jobs, but in terms of dollars spent in local businesses and the spending that happens here in La Crosse. We do this study about every 5 years, and the numbers have increased, and we're so happy to see that spending is being researched and being studied, and that we have those numbers available at our disposal to be able to say this is what the impact is that we're making in the city. So it's great to have those numbers, and yeah, it's a significant amount.
And like you said, you know, this is a study that's been done in prior years, and the numbers have changed a little bit. And I know that there has been more participation in this study. And Bridget, I wonder if you can talk about kind of what you're seeing as far as, you know, arts organizations really starting to take a look at these numbers and report them.
Sure. So 5 years ago, we had maybe about 15 or so organizations participate in the study. This year we had 33 organizations participate in the study. So it's definitely a big increase, and I think that more organizations are understanding the value. I also think in repeating the study, they understand they're going to get concrete results from it. And then also there are some organizations that just needed a couple extra reminders and got them on board. So,
yeah, Tracy, what is the value in kind of putting a number to the impact that the arts and our organizations have in La Crosse?
Well, I think that there's a misconception that if you support the arts, it's at the expense of our local economic development, when actually if you support the arts, we're giving back way more into the community than what people actually realize as far as an economic impact goes. It's definitely, supporting the arts is definitely something that will turn around and make money for the whole community.
Yeah, I wonder if you could talk a little bit about, you know, maybe some of the things that aren't captured in a study like this, that, you know, those benefits that are to the community from the arts and our organizations.
Well, I mean, just take, for example, it's beyond ticket sales for, you know, like our organizations and the impact of, you know, the employees and things that we just within our organizations. But think of all the people that go out to dinner before they go to a show or a concert. Think about the people that go out afterwards. Think about the people that go to the mall and buy a new outfit because they want to be dressed up for the December symphony concert, you know, something like that. So it's far reaching, a lot of fingers that go out into the community on an economic scale.
Jen, how does La Crosse compare to some of the other regions that were looked at in, you know, in this study? You know, Eau Claire, for example, they had a direct economic impact of a little more than $10 million compared to the city of La Crosse's $33 million. I wonder what this says about La Crosse.
Well, it's I think what it says about La Crosse, and it's something that we've known, is that La Crosse is a very arts-rich community. There are a lot of local arts organizations, and the community is really supporting those organizations. People are buying tickets. They're going to see things. They're supporting multiple arts organizations. They don't just go to one place. They go to many different organizations. And the fact that we have a community that can support that kind of arts culture and having all of those different organizations being successful in one community, I think says a lot about this community. We know that this is a wonderful place to live. We've got the bluffs, we've got the beauty of the area, and we also have this rich cultural scene that makes this area very attractive. And not only for people just wanting to live here, but for businesses wanting to bring their company here because they know that they can attract the right kind of employees that are looking for that culturally rich lifestyle. So La Crosse is a very attractive place to live for that reason, and I think the arts and the culture sector really helps support that.
Bridget, you know, I wonder, I feel like it's kind of a chicken and the egg kind of question. Having people in the community that support the arts that really is helping drive this growth? Or, you know, I wonder if it's having the arts be accessible to the community that's helping to kind of drive this growth.
Right. So I grew up in La Crosse. So I've been in and out for 26 years now. And I know when I was a kid, it was not as vibrant as it is now. So I think there are definitely key players and institutions that help to make it more accessible, and also people that donated their time, their money, whatever it may be, to really support these organizations. And I think they have responded in kind in making sure we're bringing in programming that suits different populations, that is accessible, especially to more rural areas around here. And I think it's all, again, like you said, a chicken and the egg. Some of it starts here and grows into something else, and then it just is a cycle that continues. And like Jen said, our community seems to really support the arts, and again, not just one organization, but sees the good in kind of all of it and how we need to take care of all of that.
Mm-hmm. Jen, I wonder, how do you feel like the arts scene and kind of the, I guess maybe the climate for the arts has changed over the years in La Crosse?
I actually went to college at Viterbo, and I remember going downtown when I was a college student, and even if you just walk down there, everything looks so different than it did when I was in college. You know, you look at the Weber Center for the Performing Arts, it's sitting right there on the river. And there used to be a grain elevator there, 15 years ago, that grain elevator was sitting there. And now there's this budding arts and culture district that's taking shape in that area. You've got the restaurants, you've got the hotels popping up, you've got the Pump House Regional Arts Center there, they've got the mural on the side of the wall, you've got the Weber Center there now, and all the businesses that are coming into that area. And it's just really... it's really neat to see how much that has changed in the 15 or 20 years that I've been in the community since I came here for college. And you see that happening throughout the community. You see little community organizations popping up kind of all over the place, and I think that just drives the downtown development and the neighborhood revitalization that we're looking at in the areas surrounding the downtown area.
You're listening to Newsmakers on Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm Hope Kerwin. Today we're talking about the economic impact of nonprofit organizations supporting the arts in La Crosse. We're here with Jen Robardeau from the Weber Center, Tracy Gaskin from the La Crosse Symphony Orchestra, and Bridget Misch from Viterbo University. Part of the study was looking at, attendance at arts events, and almost 38% of attendees at events in 2015 were non-residents in La Crosse, which I think is a really interesting number. Tracy, who are we attracting, and where are these people coming from, these non-residents, when they're attending events in La Crosse?
Well, I know most of us in the arts industry here in La Crosse, we're not trying to target just La Crosse residents. I mean, we have at least a 60-mile span of where we advertise and you know, reach out to into Minnesota. We have a lot of people coming in from Winona and La Crescent and Houston County that are coming into to view our arts. And I think that we try really hard to reach out as far as we can to branch out and to bring that tourism into La Crosse.
Mm-hmm. And looking at some of the other regions that were, part of this study, I know that Door County, they had 78% of their attendees were non-residents.
Well, we'll get there one day.
You know, Bridget, what do you think we can learn from a place like Door County? You know, obviously they have a little bit different tourism environment, but, you know, I wonder what we can learn from them.
I think, again, it's still continuing to reach out into the communities surrounding the area. We have plenty to draw from. I will say the people considered non-residents in this study were anybody outside of La Crosse County. So that didn't include people from Onalaska or a little bit south of here. It would be other counties that considered as non-residents. So it still provides a far reach, or people that don't consider themselves La Crosse residents as the resident attendees. But it's definitely something to continue to strive for. And I think it's still a pretty big number, considering almost a little less than half, but almost half of our residents or our attendees are non-residents. And it's just something that we have to keep reaching out to.
I think it's a collaborative effort. I think that it's working with our city governments and our chambers and Explore La Crosse. And the more we can do as a collaborative entity to get the word out that we are a destination. There's so much to do in La Crosse. I don't think it happens overnight. I think Door County has probably been doing this since before I was born. So I think that we're doing a much better job as a city and, you know, as a whole. But it definitely needs to just keep getting bigger and bigger so that people are looking at us as a destination.
I know that this was a part of a larger national study, but it also looked at Wisconsin as a whole and the economic impact of the arts in that. You know, Jen, you know, I wonder what your thoughts are on how Wisconsin is doing when you look at these numbers.
Well, I think Wisconsin is doing pretty well when you look at the national numbers and compare them to the numbers from Wisconsin. Wisconsin is a state that that has arts-rich communities throughout. As we meet people from other communities, you know, and our colleagues throughout the state, many of them are in similar situations. They're in communities where they have a very supportive community that wants to see an arts organization thrive in their community. Even the smaller towns, many of them will have a school-based or some sort of community arts center that's taking shape. And I think throughout Wisconsin as a whole, that is something that we can be proud of, because we are a state that values the arts, and we have many communities that support arts-rich communities. I think that there are probably areas of the state that do better than others. And I think, you know, you get to the eastern side of the state, the more populated areas, I think you'll find that there are more arts organizations and more opportunities than in some of the smaller, more rural communities, more centrally located. But again, you still see some of those little community arts organizations popping up in some of these smaller towns, and I think that reach is starting to be more widespread.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Bridget, I wonder how you feel like Wisconsin maybe compares to our neighbors. You know, we're drawing people from Minnesota, but I wonder if, you know, if they are seeing a similar effect.
Right. So in looking at some of the national findings, Illinois' big draw is obviously Chicago. So many of their findings come from that region. I'm sure they have other regions as well, but I know that's their big draw. Minnesota has always been a very big supporter of the arts and still continues to be a nationally number one ranked state as far as supporting the arts. So unfortunately, we have the best, you know, state next to us, so we're not quite up there. But as again, like Jen said, we're still a very supportive community of the arts, and again, especially within the little local organizations trying to support those throughout the communities in Wisconsin.
Yeah, Tracy, do you feel like there are things we can, you know, as a state, we can learn from Minnesota and from Illinois to better support, you know, the arts across the state?
Well, I'm from Illinois, but not from Chicago. So there's really not a whole lot to learn from Illinois except for Chicago. Not to knock my home state, but they're in a little bit of trouble right now. I think that Minnesota is a wonderful example of what we can strive, you know, like our goal to kind of be. Their state is amazing with how they support their arts organizations, but I think that we're getting there, and a lot of what I see just in the 12 years that I've been in Wisconsin and in La Crosse, a form of collaboration with all arts organizations, even statewide, that I did not see when I was here 12 years ago. So a lot of us are working more closely together instead of looking at each other like competitors. We're looking at each other as, you know, if we come together and make this bigger and better, we're just going to continue to grow. And I think that's the biggest impact that we've had so far.
What do you think is maybe driving that change?
I think it's the individual organizations themselves. I think that, you know, you get, I mean, like, look at these guys. They're super young, and they just have a different vision as they come into the into our organization. As the generation changes, I think that the philosophy of how we operate changes as well. I think that happens on a board level as well within each of our organizations. I can speak for La Crosse. All of our arts organizations, our board members are amazing, and a lot of them, just like Jen was saying, our patrons don't necessarily just go to one. They support a lot. Our board members, I think, are the same way. You'll find people that were on my board are now on the Weber board, and that, you know, and they're also on the Viterbo board of directors and everything too. So I think that when you have a community that is so passionate about enhancing the lives of everyone here, and part of that is through the arts, that's what really makes a difference and makes us all come together as more of one industry instead of individual organizations.
Yeah, Jen, I wonder what your thoughts are on these benefits of collaboration among arts organizations. I feel like the Weber Center and La Crosse Community Theater is a great example of organizations sharing space and resources. Mm-hmm. I wonder what your thoughts are on this.
Yeah, I definitely see more of that collaboration happening, and I think that that's really important to the success of the arts in the community. You know, we all talk as colleagues. You know, I see Tracy on a fairly regular basis. I work with Bridget. And so, you know, we do see each other. We talk about things. We bounce ideas off of each other. Hey, have you dealt with this situation? How are you handling this? You know, so we see each other as a resource. And like Tracy said, not so much as competitors anymore. We are competing in some way. But we also understand that if the Weber Center is successful, Viterbo will also be successful. The symphony will also be successful. And it's just kind of this domino effect in the community that if one arts organization is successful, that translates over to many of the other organizations. If there's an organization that's failing, that's going to be bad for the whole arts community, because if that organization goes away, there's this hole now. So we all want to support each other. We want to work together, and we want to see everyone be successful, because we also have our own mission, we have our own product, and there's room for all those different products in this community.
This study is obviously looking at kind of the impact of these arts organizations on the economics of La Crosse. But, you know, I wonder what trends we're seeing when it comes to, you know, community supporting these nonprofit organizations.
I think funding in La Crosse right now is, the generosity is mind-blowing. It's incredibly humbling. The businesses, the individuals who care so much about the arts is, it's heartwarming. I know that with our organization, we have a little over $700,000 budget, and only 31% comes from ticket sales. The rest come from individuals and sponsorships of organizations in this community. We have a few grants, a couple of foundations and things. We're not grant-driven, our organization personally, so I can attest to, it's for us, it's mostly individuals and businesses. And a lot of the businesses, and individuals you'll see in all of our programs, that they're contributors for all of us. They spread their wealth. They're incredibly generous. I can't even begin to inform our community, people who don't necessarily go to the arts all the time or come downtown very often or whatever, how lucky they are that if they do want to, it's here. And it's because of certain individuals in this community that have made that happen. So we're all really, really lucky.
Yeah, Jen, from your perspective, what trends are you seeing as far as, community support? And I also wonder trends in attendance, if you're seeing, more or less people seeking out these events.
I think attendance on the whole is strong because obviously we have the many organizations that are doing well. And I think my observation is that we have less of the patron who is very loyal to one organization and only purchases their season ticket package at one organization nowadays. And we're seeing more of the patron that is spreading their money a little bit more among the different arts organizations. They'll go to see a concert at the Symphony, but then they'll come to the Weber Center the next weekend and see something, and then they may go to a Turbo the following weekend and see something. So you have that patron who's a little bit more interested in trying some different things and seeing something different. They don't just tend to stick to one place. And I think that's true in their philanthropy as well. I mean, Tracy mentioned we see not only the corporations, but the individuals are contributing to many of the arts organizations, not necessarily just one place. So if they have tickets at the Symphony and maybe they're a donor to the Symphony, they may also be a donor at Viterbo or at the Weber Center or at the Pump House or another organization. And like Tracy mentioned earlier, too, they may serve on multiple boards. So they're not only philanthropically involved in that aspect, but they're also interested in volunteering or perhaps helping from that standpoint. So I think we just have a much more committed and interested audience base in this community that wants to see many different things happening.
How does that change your work, knowing that about that you're not necessarily going to get someone who contributes a lot to one organization?
What it means is we have to get the word out to our patrons that support is needed. If patrons know that you rely on their donations and their contributions in addition to their ticket support, I think you'll find that many in this community are very willing to support in some way. We just have to do a good job of making sure that they know what the needs are and that we give them the opportunity to contribute in other ways other than just pushing buying tickets all the time.
Jen Robardeau, Interim Executive Director of the Weber Center for the Performing Arts, is here with us today to talk about the $33 million economic activity generated by nonprofit art organizations in La Crosse. She's joined by Tracy Gaskin, Executive Director of the La Crosse Symphony Orchestra, and Bridget Misch, Event Operations Coordinator for Viterbo University's Fine Arts Center. Coming up, we'll talk about economic trends in another field, higher education. We'll hear from economists about the community impacts of student debt, high tuition, and more. You're listening to Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm Hope Kerwin. To hear audio archives of today's show, visit our website, wpr.org/newsmakers. From Wisconsin Public Radio and La Crosse, this is Newsmakers. I'm Hope Kerwin. This week, the University of Wisconsin Board of Regents is considering a plan to consolidate the state's two-year colleges with four-year universities. It's the latest in a series of changes to the UW system over the last few years. From rising student loan debt to tuition freezes, the economics of higher education has been a major issue in Wisconsin and in the U.S. UW La Crosse recently brought together several economists for a conference on education, and we wanted to talk with them about some of these higher education trends. Our guests include David Yeager, a professor of economics at City University of New York, Chris Walters, an assistant professor of economics at the University of California, Berkeley, and John Nunley, associate professor of economics at UW La Crosse. WPR's John Davis started the conversation by asking David Yeager to talk about how the country got to the current situation with high tuition and record levels of student debt.
I mean, there are a variety of things I think that have affected tuition. One is the reduction in state grants to universities that I think has certainly had an effect. But I think the other thing to keep in mind is that the sticker price that most universities show, at least private universities, is not necessarily what people pay. So I think there's a bit of a reaction to the sticker price of expensive places like Harvard or Princeton, but in reality, not everybody, or not even most students, pay that sticker price.
John or Chris, do you want to chime in with your thoughts?
I would agree with this first point about the decline in state support. You know, I forget the exact years, but I actually looked this up once for UW La Crosse specifically, and I think it was probably around 1980, in that range, where basically about 80 cents on the dollar was state appropriations. And today, that's about 20 cents on the dollar. So it's the ratio has completely flipped in 30 years or 35 years or so. And that's been a steady decline too. So I think that's a big deal. I guess the other thing too is cost rise. I mean, if you think about the type of people who are employed at a university, right? They have high levels of educational attainment, the highest levels you can get. That tends to be a little bit more expensive, right? And so I think that probably plays a big role too. You need the professors, right? And so I mean, you have to pay them to compete for them, and I think that obviously contributes too.
Yeah, there's been rising since the 80s. Been rising skill premium, right? So mm-hmm. higher, better educated people, earn more, and so right. In order to attract people into the professoriate, you need to pay them. But Chris certainly has something to say about
yeah, this. I mean, that kind of leads to another point, which is that I think it's important for people to keep in mind when they consider these issues, which is that the kind of return to earning a college degree relative to not doing so is higher now than it's ever been, even accounting for the rise in price that students face. So it's definitely true that student debt is increasing and tuition has increased, but college has not become a bad deal for people.
I had the opportunity to sit in a little bit on the presentations during the conference, and from Chris's study, I learned that during a 20-year period from the mid-90s, student loan debt tripled, while higher education saw a decline in spending from state legislatures of about 30%. Has that been kind of a perfect storm? Why we've seen higher education costs rise?
That's another important trend in American higher education, which I think gets a little bit less attention than rising tuition prices, but seems to be also quite important in explaining how the system is functioning. So states over time have appropriated less money to their schools. And so despite the fact that people are paying more for college, the amount of resources that are spent on any given student's education, including what they pay and what the state pays in, on average has declined. So people are sort of paying more, but less resources are being spent. And the study that I was describing today suggests that that has an impact on student outcomes in the sense that degree completion and student enrollment are affected by the resources that the school has to spend on its students. So it's not just about the price of college, it's also about the cost in terms of resources spent, and the resources seem to be an important part of the story.
Your studies suggest tuition freezes, while maybe well-meaning and something to appease parents and students by politicians, may not be the best way to go in the long run?
I'm not sure I'd go that far. I don't exactly have an opinion on whether tuition freezes are a good or a bad idea. What we show in the study is that tuition prices do seem to reduce tuition growth. So they seem to be kind of effective at the stated goal of constraining tuition growth, but they don't seem to have much of an impact on student outcomes. And in some cases, if a tuition freeze is commensurate with a decline in spending, so if it's not offset by the state sort of appropriating the extra money that would have been coming in through tuition, that can have an impact on student outcomes.
What kind of impact?
So what we show is that people are less likely to kind of maintain their enrollment and to ultimately complete their degree when schools have less resources. So schools might have less resources because less money is appropriated from the state to the school, or because they're less able to bring in tuition money because they're under a cap or a freeze. So that part of the equation is important to think about when considering policies on either of these dimensions, either constraining tuition growth or deciding how to set state appropriations. It seems like that's not cutting appropriations or constraining tuition growth are not costless policies in that sense.
What do those two lead to that would reduce the ability of someone to graduate from college?
So in our study, that's not entirely clear because the data that we're using, we can't see exactly what's happening at the campus level, but there's a lot of kind of mechanisms through which you might expect something like that to operate. For example, when schools have less money, we show that there's less instructional spending. They may offer less classes. They may offer less academic support services for students, which other studies have shown can have large impacts on student graduation rates. You know, our results suggest that the money that schools lose when they experience a state budget cut isn't kind of superfluous money that's being spent on consumption amenities or things like that. It goes to kind of core academic spending at a lot of schools. And that type of spending on class sizes or instructors or student supports, we know from other evidence, is important for explaining how quickly students are able to get through college.
These concepts we're talking about, higher tuition, greater student debt, it's a nationwide issue, correct? It's not just limited to Wisconsin or New York or California. It's all over.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, there is variation in the kind of cutbacks and appropriations, I think, on some level, but I don't know any state that is filling its public universities with tons of money. You might see some differences across the states based on the appropriations, but most public university systems that I know of are feeling a pinch from reduced appropriations.
Right. We all know the economy has been kind of sluggish in America, probably during the same years that we've seen this. These struggles with economics in higher education. Is there a correlation there between the two?
I would say there's probably more than a correlation. There's a common phrase that state higher education systems are the balance wheel of state budgets. So, you know, a lot of states have balanced budget amendments where they're required to balance their budgets. And as their revenues fall, when the business cycle sort of takes a downturn, a lot of times higher education spending is something that is on the chopping block. So I don't think it's a coincidence that if you look at the trends in appropriations for higher education, in some places they took a dive around the time of the financial crisis, that it's probably directly connected to this kind of set of issues.
I would just add one thing, I haven't seen evidence on this necessarily, but I've sort of heard it discussed that, you know, healthcare expenditures by states sort of have a potential crowd out effect too, right? If the state's allocating more and more funds to, you know, there's, you know, in here in the state of Wisconsin, Badger Care, right, could very well, even independent of a recession, right, could you know, reduce some of the support for higher education. And then I guess if you had both of those things, which we had, right? I mean, healthcare expenditures and have been rising rapidly, and I think that forces states with balanced budgets to even tighten more.
You're listening to Newsmakers on Wisconsin Public Radio La Crosse. I'm John Davis. We are talking with a panel of economists about some of the major trends in higher education. Our guests include John Nunley, Associate Professor of Economics at UW-La Crosse, David Yeager, a Professor of Economics at City University of New York, and Chris Walters, an Assistant Professor of Economics at the University of California, Berkeley. They participated in a recent Economics of Education conference at UW-La Crosse. It's interesting. There are so many issues that are interrelated. Healthcare spending, which has gone up incredibly. You've got a need to educate more people in healthcare to take care of an aging population. And in states like Wisconsin, which is losing young people to the brain drain, and I know there are a lot of states like that. So these are some very serious economic problems we're having. How do you start to dig out from that?
I could try to comment on the brain drain, because I've been posed this question before. I just spoke at the governor's small business summit a few weeks ago, and about David and my research also with Alan Seals on internships. And one of the things that, and I don't have evidence that this would help, but, you know, if you look at Wisconsin, Wisconsin is a very low providing state of internships, say relative to Minneapolis. So a lot of kids that go to UW-La Crosse, UW-Eau Claire, I think a lot of them intern in Minneapolis, and they end up working in Minneapolis. I mean, there appears to be some link, right, between interning and then getting a job. And so I sort of told the people at the business summit, the business leaders there, that this would be maybe a useful thing for them to do. I mean, you know, if the internship is truly a way for a young college graduate or person that will graduate soon to match with a firm, that might be a way to keep them here and not lose them to Minneapolis or Chicago, which seems to be the two places where a lot of college graduates from Wisconsin end up.
I wanted to talk about your internship study a bit. And what is the premise or what were you looking at in the study, David?
We know very little about the market for interns. There's almost no academic or economic research on how the market for interns functions. So one of the fundamental goals was just to be able to describe what the demand for interns looks like. So part of it was just to do some sort of fundamental descriptive research. The second part of it was to actually look at what determines whether a student is likely to be called back for an internship. We don't observe people actually getting internships, but we can observe what characteristics of the students affect whether they are likely to be called back for an internship. So what was really interesting about that was that we found that having an internship previously was an important determinant of getting a subsequent internship, which in itself raises the question of how do you get that first internship? How do you sort of gain entry into the internship market, and then presumably that has an effect on working in the job market. So, you know, I think there are some lessons to be learned, maybe subsidies for internships. As John was saying, if you want to retain people in Wisconsin, then maybe one thing to do is to encourage students to do their internships here. And not every student can afford to do an unpaid internship. So one way to allow students of lesser means to do an unpaid internship, to get that first set of experiences, might be to offer some kind of subsidy. Now, in a environment with difficult state budgets, that's a tall order, perhaps. But there's at least some suggestive evidence that having an internship is important for getting another internship, which is in turn important for getting a job.
A government-subsidized internship, or the business is paying for them?
Well, I mean, of course, being paid for during an internship is one way to allow people to do it, especially if they don't come from a family that would allow them to work without getting paid. So, yeah, for sure, paid internships are one way to go about doing that. But not all firms are perhaps willing to provide internships with pay, and so for unpaid internships, having a government subsidy might be a way to do it, or to have universities themselves allow students to spend some time doing an internship. I know that's in some private universities that's done. There are grants for students to do an unpaid internship.
Yeah, so I could add one thing to that. I think it's also important to point out that to a firm, an unpaid internship is not necessarily free, right? The firm would need to allocate some resources to the intern, train the intern in some way. It's hard to know how costly it is to them, but it's not zero. And so I think that the subsidy that David is describing would obviously help with that, right? Because there's going to be some firms where maybe it's not beneficial for them to pay an intern. Maybe they can't benefit from that. The subsidy would obviously allow them to do an unpaid internship and still have students be attracted to the internship.
I know there's often a cost to students with these internships as well. They have to pick up their roots and move somewhere for 3 months, not get paid, and I know there was three or four years ago some kerfuffle about should students be paid for this slave labor they're giving companies, and don't the students deserve a right to some sort of subsidy as well?
Well, I think that comes down to the question of whether an internship is fundamentally a kind of employment relationship, or whether it's fundamentally an educational experience. Probably most internships serve both functions. For sure, if students are providing actual work and actual productivity to the firm, they should be compensated for it. Firms will argue that the compensation is the educational experience that they gain. So I think it's a sticky issue, mm-hmm. One that I think is still somewhat legally up in the air. I don't have any great answer to that question.
Yeah, I don't know that I do either. I will say, I mean, there's limited evidence, right, that internships help people get jobs.
Yeah.
And even from Germany, right, there's some evidence, right, that it leads to higher wages in the long term, right,
yeah.
So when you're older. So I mean, you could make a case that students should be willing to trade that off, right, get the credential or the put on their resume that helps them get the job and then the higher wages later in life. But I think all else equal, it'd be good if they were paid.
And I think it's also a question of from a societal perspective, one of inequality.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Students whose families cannot afford to support them while they do an unpaid internship, that means that they can't, those opportunities are not available to them. And to the extent that those opportunities are important for subsequent success, this could just exacerbate inequality.
I agree very much with that, yes.
I don't know if your research looked at this or not, but do most internships, whether they're paid or unpaid, lead to a job with the company that the student is interning with?
We don't know.
the only evidence on that is from the National Association of Colleges and Employers.
Right.
They have some statistics. I haven't seen the raw data. For example, I remember one statistic that if a student interns with a firm twice, 90% of those are offered a job, and then of that 90%, 90% accept the job. So I think that there's probably a connection there, but in terms of our study, we don't have direct evidence of that.
So in Wisconsin right now, the hot topic in higher education is this consolidation of 2 and 4 year campuses. And many of the details are yet to be worked out as we're doing this interview. And I'll start with you, John. What is your reaction to what we're doing in Wisconsin? And what will it mean for the long run? Historically, the UW system, I think, is probably seen as one of the top systems, education systems in the country since it was established, what, 1970, something like that, 50 years ago? And maybe you all want to comment on this, but is this just further unraveling of that system?
Yeah, that's a good question. I wouldn't say that I'm too knowledgeable about this. I mean, didn't we have a conversation about this has happened in California and in Virginia, I think, that not in Virginia?
Not consolidation.
Not consolidation.
No, okay.
Sort of the
mandating acceptance.
Yeah.
Okay. Of two-year credits and two-year degrees. Let me just say that there are a variety of roles that a university education serves, or four-year university education. One is obviously the knowledge that gets transferred to the students that makes them more productive. But there's another view that labor economists have that education serves a signaling role, the signal that students are already productive, are productive. Mm-hmm. And I think this sort of merging two-year schools with four-year schools potentially could dilute the sort of credentialing aspect of the four-year schools. Sort of going to one of the Wisconsin campuses as a signal of being a productive person, which is not to say that two-year schools don't make people productive, but there's a reputation that particular campuses have, and consolidation will affect that reputation.
But if the bars are to been kind of lowered all over the country, does that matter if the reputation is hurt?
I know reputations are hard to win and easy to lose, I think. I would be if I were the president of one of the four-year universities, I would be somewhat wary about taking on a two-year school under the same name, and I can understand there are benefits to consolidating the administrative functions of mm-hmm. a two-year school and a four-year school, but I would be concerned about how that would affect the perception of graduates of the four-year school in the long run.
I want to get back to America's economy, I guess, and how higher education fits into it in the future. In Wisconsin, at least from what I'm aware of, we have a low unemployment rate, and it's my understanding there are jobs out there to be filled, but we have people who do not have the skills to fill those jobs. I question whether a lot of those jobs are four-year higher education jobs that are filled. They're more the technical college positions. What does that mean for the future of higher education, do you think, at least in Wisconsin? I'm sure it's very similar in other states as well.
I think there's good evidence that both four-year and kind of technical-focused two-year degrees have good labor market returns for students. So it's not just getting a four-year degree, but finishing a two-year program is valuable, probably for some of the reasons you just mentioned. As this relates to the higher education system as a whole, I think like this sort of highlights one major issue we've been having over the last few decades, which is the sort of completion crisis, you might call it, sometimes called. So students have been attending college of various types, 2 and 4 year, at higher rates over time, but the number of students who actually complete a degree has not grown very quickly. And a lot of that is coming from the fact that many students enroll and stick around for a little while and then don't finish. And it's a good question why that's happening. There's a lot of kind of research trying to understand this. But I think for the reasons you just described, you know, getting some of those marginal kids through the program, there's reason to believe that that would have economic benefits for them. So that's one thing we should be looking at as we consider the higher education system in the U.S. and Wisconsin specifically.
Yeah, and there's evidence that completing a degree, there's a big return to completing a degree, even if the amount of time you spent in school is roughly the same. So the completion is a really important part of the system, that figuring out how to get students to complete, I think, is really is a big deal.
We've been hearing from David Yeager, a professor of economics at City University of New York, Chris Walters, an assistant professor of economics at the University of California, Berkeley, and John Nunley, associate professor of economics at UW La Crosse. They spoke with WPR's John Davis about trends in higher education during a visit to UW La Crosse for a conference on the economics of education. And that's Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm Hope Kerwin. The executive producer for Newsmakers is John Gatto, and our senior news editor and producer is John Davis. If you missed part of today's show, you can find the audio archives at wpr.org/newsmakers. Our site also has archives of other past editions of Newsmakers, and if you'd like to share comments or make suggestions for future shows, you'll find links to our producers and staff. That and more at wpr.org/newsmakers.